My journey has been one of returning from the darkness and stepping out into the light once more. I'm Chance Lunsford. I'm also Logos Centrifugal. While you're sitting trying to figure that out,
this is my podcast.
Allegedly. Logos Centrifugal Podcast. I'm Chance Lunsford. I'm also Logos Centrifugal. Maybe you're also Logos Centrifugal. While you're trying to figure out what the hell that even means, let me introduce today's magnificent, unique, and vastly intelligent guest. It's Kurt Schlichter.
Hey, it's right that you compliment me. I it's not like I have a giant ego or anything.
I'm just getting you good and buttered up so I can drop the bombs later.
Excellent, excellent. You know, I've been doing this book tour for a while. Nobody's really dropping bombs. I've noticed after I've done like 60 hits, right? Nobody who really disagrees with me wants to talk to me, and I just find that bizarre. Doesn't that seem weird to you? That no, you know, it's. I mean, there's a room for high fiving, but you know, I just kind of think it's weird. So,
well, you know, that's actually. Last time I talked to you on this podcast, I kind of asked you whether or not you felt that your approach was changing minds. And you said, well, I don't necessarily, that's not what I'm about. My team needs a guy to remind them that there's people on their side and that, you know, if I can be a general or a cheerleader or whatever for these people, that's kind of what I'm here to do. And so,
that's right.
You know, maybe that cultivated persona is working out for you in that regard.
Well, it very well could, but boy, man, if somebody can take me down, isn't that bigger than like some squishy Lincoln Project weasel? Well, I don't know. Just thinking. Just wondering. Thinking out loud.
Well, I do have to say, as cornball as that introduction was, you're a smart dude on a couple levels. As I've been reading your book, I skimmed through it so I could get a good idea. And it's the 21 biggest lies about Donald Trump and you. Did I get that right?
That is it. That's the title. Sounds like a BuzzFeed listicle, huh? But it's not. It's not. But, you know, I'm afraid people are going to go, you know, oh, it's just like, oh, okay. Eh. But it's got a lot of Kurt personality. If you read my stuff at Town Hall, you're going to go, oh, now he can swear. So that's fun.
Well, one of the things that stands out about what you do in general, but specifically in this book where you got a little more room to breathe and to think, is it's clear that you are a lot of the things you are. It's clear that you're a funny guy. You use humor very effectively. I found myself laughing out loud and reading lines to my
Good.
Wife. And, you know, she just kind of chuckles and says, that sounds like it's right up your alley. But you do a very good job of sort of elucidating in a very clear way what's really being said, the reasons for it, and then sort of highlighting the counter argument, which is, well, these are the facts and this is the reality, and then these are the things that are being said, and the gap between this is where the liars like to hang out, and they say these things about Donald Trump, and what they're really saying them about is you, because by proxy he's sort of the guy that you voted for, and now they're sort of dropping bombs on you with this stuff, and
yep.
You do a very good job of, you know, I could read something like this that didn't have the power of humor in it, and it could be just a very
dry
exploration
it'd be a
of these things.
Mark.
Yeah, that's exactly. But as I'm reading this, and it's interesting too, because I don't necessarily. I find myself nodding along even on points where I'm not necessarily sure that I'm on board with you. And that humor is a powerful tool. And I'm not like from you, but yeah, go for it.
Yeah, look, I think, one of the points of the book is that for kind of the modern liberal establishment type, argument is beside the point because they just don't care. They will say or do whatever they need to get their power, and it just doesn't matter to them. I'm not even sure where one of my questions in the book is, do they actually believe this stuff, or do they just think or do they not believe and they're just cynical and think we're stupid? But for normal people, the power of argument and reason still exists. you can still talk to people and say, hey, if Donald Trump's such a racist, right? He's one of the most photographed recorded guys in the world, even before he became president, right? Right? If he was this raging racist, like they said, you'd think they'd have caught something on tape. And you'd think there probably wouldn't be quite so many pictures of him with people of all races and creeds and whatever. I mean, it just doesn't, it just doesn't fit. And a normal person's going to say, those are good points. I don't know if I'm completely convinced, but that is a good point. He's been on camera a lot, and boy, if they had anything bad on him, it'd be all over. And everybody'd know about it. So maybe because they don't, that might be an indicator. I mean, maybe he's just really good at decades and decades and decades of hiding it. That's possible. But the point is, normal people will go, okay, well, I didn't think of that, but that might change my mind. So argument's still possible. I'm not against arguing. I mean, I'm a lawyer. I am against arguing with members of the kind of liberal elite, the kind of sociology major types, because they just don't care. And it's a waste of your valuable time. And you can do more damage to them fighting back by, say, voting than trying to reason with someone who isn't interested in reason.
There's something that I've been sort of exploring, and maybe you can help me think about this a little bit, because as I look at the situation, I see a lot of sort of Antonio Gramsci Marxism at play. Long march through the institutions, infiltrating the education and the media and the government, and sort of sweeping away the previous culture to replace it with this totalitarian world-governing Marxist body, essentially. But when I try to say that to people and tell them to go read the prison notebooks or something, they just kind of like glaze over. It's like, what? And so I guess I wonder.
Yeah, I look, Americans are a practical people. So, reading a bunch of Gramsci is probably not on their agenda. But when they see, the guys at the Major League Baseball are all excited about kneeling, okay, then they feel it. Then they're like, what is this bullshit?
Yeah.
And then they see it. Hmm. And they're like, and I can't tell you, just today, last night the 49 or whoever the San Francisco, who are they? Who's the San Francisco team? Whatever the San Francisco team is, was kneeling. And, I'm not a baseball guy, but a lot of people have said, I saw that yesterday. The Giants, I guess it is. The Giants were kneeling. I'm never watching baseball again. Hmm. I mean, just like, wow. The thing is, what they've done is they've marched through the institutions, but let's look at our institutions. Our institutions were dying for a number of reasons. First, they're just old. Our institutions really started coming about after World War II. That's 70 years ago. That's almost, we're moving in on they're a century old, and they haven't changed a lot. You get educated in college essentially the same way today, essentially, as you did 100 years ago. So there's a whole bunch of technological pressure that's moving on all these institutions. The media, for instance, has the internet, which has changed newspapers and television. Academia has come under technological pressure, especially compounded by this pandemic, because we're suddenly finding out, I can get an education. I don't have to spend $50,000 for the school. And of course, Harvard says to do distance learning, you still pay us the same amount. Don't worry, you'll get a Harvard diploma. That's what you're buying. So there's all these that was going to kill them, especially at the prices they're charged. $200 coming out with a sociology degree and $200,000 in debt. And all you can do is fix lattes at the local Starbucks. That's a bad deal. And I've actually noticed, high school kids going, I don't want to go to college the way you guys did, because it's going to ruin my life. I'm going to spend 4 years getting nothing, and then I'm going to have all this debt. I want a different path. So there's huge pressure on the institutions anyway, because they're old. And that's all the institutions. Hollywood, the NFL, for instance. Look at what's happening, finally catching up with the injuries. That's changing everything. It's just all the institutions were old and exhausted, and they're run by old, exhausted people. The folks who run the institutions now inherited them. Think of them as like the third generation of the guys who built stuff, like Rockefeller or Henry Ford, John Rockefeller or Henry Ford. They built their countries. They know our companies. They know what it was like to sweat, to take risks, to work hard, to persevere. And then their sons and daughters got it. And now it's the third generation who were just handed it to. They're really running off a cultural trust fund in our institutions. They didn't build it. They're not good. By the way, can you name a third generation Ford? I can't. The last Rockefeller I heard of was the guy who got eaten in New Guinea. Literally. I mean, that was the last interesting one of these. The point I'm trying to make is these are, you know, lesser grandsons. They're not accomplished on their own. They didn't build this stuff. They inherited it. So they have no real, they don't have the same kind of love and care and understanding of its essentials because they didn't build it. They were just handed it. So these institutions were always dying. And now what's interesting is the Gramscians have marched through institutions that are about to topple over. So what we have now is a revolution of the elite against normal people who are saying we're unsatisfied with these institutions to take control of institutions that are already wobbling.
So I guess then I'm curious, it seems to me to be the case that, you know, you come right out and say it in the book. I'm actually talking about you, the reader here.
Yeah.
Donald Trump is a vector. And Donald Trump
is an avatar.
Yeah, exactly. And he's such a potent one. So effective at drawing the attention. But I guess I wonder how much of this whole situation, the crumbling institutions, the sort of desperate gambit to maintain some sort of control over these institutions and through that the populace, how much of it is being threatened by Donald Trump and his voters? I mean, I guess I just wonder.
I think everything, because we are dissatisfied with how society has functioned. I mean, look at the generations. The generations of 40s gave us beat the Nazis, beat the Depression. The 60s put a man on the moon. They actually dismantled real systemic racism. Our generation's given us Iraq, the Wall Street meltdown, and Grindr. I mean, our institution, they're just not doing their job for us. And we're, you know, Americans are like, okay, next. So they're trying to keep the institutions that are failing relevant. They're trying to keep their own position relevant, but they're exhausted. And they, you know, they've got this tiger of the hard left that they were hoping they could turn on us to suppress us, but it really can't suppress us. There's not that many of them. There's maybe a million of these hardcore leftists out of 330 million. And there's 400 million guns in this country. Okay. I'm not worried about them physically killing me. Okay. Because, you know, more of them are going to go than me. I am worried about them getting power in the government, and I'm annoyed that they're getting power in the institutions, which are still important, even if they're dying. But the simple fact is, you know, the left tried to use them, and they're not really that many of them, and they can't really do anything to us, the kind of more normal people. Yeah, occasionally somebody will get canceled for having a Trump bumper sticker on his truck. That stuff's going to start getting remedied. There's going to be lawsuits and everything, and I think that stuff's going to kind of work through as people see the inherent unfairness of it and refuse to go along with it. But the people who are really suffering are the kind of center-left institutional heads themselves. Look what happened at the New York Times when they ran that Tom Cotton editorial. He writes an editorial saying we should use military force to suppress these riots. Now, I've been part of a military operation suppressing riots in Los Angeles. I wrote my law review article on it. And I don't think that was appropriate here because this is a different kind of violence than Los Angeles. Los Angeles was mass crime. This is targeted violence designed to provide street theater. That's why they knock down statues, because it makes a good picture. They don't actually control ground. These leftists actually control maybe 20 football fields worth of territory in the entire United States. This is all a mental game. It's all information operation designed to change, to get a reaction from us, make us feel unsafe, insecure, etc. We're invulnerable, but the center left is weak. And in the New York Times issue, he writes this editorial, they run it. The newsroom explodes with these young 20-something millennials. I'm literally shaking that you ran this Tom Cotton article, which, according to polls, and these are ones I believe because they're not particularly political, about 60% of Americans believe in his viewpoint. So a sitting senator writes a very mainstream article, op-ed, that runs in the New York Times. Newsroom explodes. And the newspaper editorial staff is too weak and scared to tell these kids, shut up. No, we're going to run this. And if you don't like it, go find another job. There's 100 people who want this job here at the New York Times. So sit down, be professional, and stop your nonsense. If you are truly literally shaking because of something you read, perhaps you ought to be in a different line of work. Now, that's how any of us would respond. They rolled over. They fire their manager and start kissing ass. It's pathetic. They're exhausted and they're weak.
So that kind of leads me into a little different avenue, which is, okay, let's take as a given that the old institutions are worn out and failing, and they're sort of being run by people who hold these sort of set of ridiculous social values.
Yes.
I wonder, in order to transition into a new paradigm, there's going to have to be some turbulence. And I guess we're experiencing some of that. But I mean, you figure it's going to be flames.
Creative disruption.
Do you think it's going to get?
That is a great question. That's the $10,000 question. I don't know the answer. If you look at history, turbulent times often mean violence. Now, we have, as a society, as a Western civilization, we have, instead of embracing violence like the Romans or the Greeks, for instance, who are revolution after revolution after revolution in their history. They embraced violence. They thought violence was a perfect, I won't say they thought it was perfectly legitimate, but it became perfectly legitimized. And that's the danger. It becomes normalized. You know, the old Republic of Rome, it'd be a scandal if somebody got murdered. You know, fast forward 100 years, everybody's getting killed and thrown in the Tiber. There is a chance that would happen here. Now, I've been the ruins of that. That happened in Kosovo. The Serbs had lived in peace with the Albanians under Tito, kind of an enforced paradigm of peace for a couple generations. Tito dies. Some Serbian radicals come to power and use that and use the grievances as leverage. They embrace violence. They try and drive the Albanians out. The world reacted, and the Albanians then drove the Serbs out. And those were the ruined villages I walked through. They were old Serbian villages. They started it. It got out of control. I don't know if this is going to get out of control. I mean, we have a very, very strong norm against violence for political gain. But we're seeing people in Portland, for instance, reject that norm. And you can't have two sets of rules for very long. It doesn't work. People are not going to say, well, you know, you can use violence, but I'm not going to dirty my hands. No, there'll be some people who say that. And some people will say, we shouldn't do it. But eventually, the lowest common denominator is going to prevail. So if that keeps up, I think it's almost inevitable there'll be violence. If we stand up and refuse to accept it, And that, unfortunately, the liberal establishment and the Democrat Party are covering for it. I mean, they're screaming about office protecting federal property. You know, you should stop that. And what? Let them burn it down? Well, they don't want to say that, but you know, you should reasonably expect someone to want the reasonably expected consequences of the actions he advocates. I think it's tremendously short-sighted to think that you're going to be able to secure an advantage by being the guy who's willing to use force, fully expecting that the other guy will not want to use force in response. That's crazy. No one will ever do that. And I don't understand why they think so. I don't understand how they expect two sets of rules to last without becoming an outright dictatorship by somebody. In dictatorships, that happens. In free societies or societies that have a respect for individual rights, like the Romans and Greeks imperfectly did, it's just impossible.
Do you suppose that maybe that this is sort of like a desperate gambit, because the reality is that there is a mass recognition that the media is failing, the government needs some reform, the education system's a joke, and it's maybe like let's like throw out all our cards on the table and really try to
hold on a little longer,
because if not, we got to spend another 100 years trying to infiltrate again.
Well, I mean. They've infiltrated, and then they've infiltrated, you know, this Jenga tower that has half the blocks pulled out. Yeah. And suddenly they're like, okay, I've got academia. Oh, lucky you. You can have it. something's good. Look, something's always going to develop on the ashes. Creative destruction is a process. It happens in societies. There's going to be change. These guys are not, you know, they say conservatives are trying to conserve things. Not in this case. It's the left that wants to conserve things. This is a reaction. It's a reaction specifically to the normal people picking Trump as a way of saying stop. We need something different. This isn't working. They are trying to go back, and Joe Biden will tell you, well, let's go back to how it was under Obama. But of course, under Obama was the problem for the vast majority of people. Yeah, if you were one of the elite under Obama, it's pretty good for you. But most people aren't. You know, the guy whose job got outsourced, or the person whose wages haven't gone up in 10 years, or the guy whose kid is on OxyContin or fentanyl, or the gal who's Ford Explorer got rear-ended, illegal alien who goes, oh, no bueno, no insurance, oh. These issues were very real to normal people, and the elite didn't want to address them, because to address them would require change that would diminish their own power.
Hmm. Well, you know, that I guess what this whole sort of tangent just kind of makes me think of is, on the one hand, you have a situation where there's a significant tendency in a significant group of people to prefer a fantasy to reality. And that's one thing. Everybody has their sort of ideals that they'd like to see brought into the world. But that tendency in a lot of people has been sort of co-opted and distorted into this really bizarre view of the world, where things like biology and effort and relationships aren't real, or are based on these sort of foundations of fallacy after fallacy. And I guess I wonder, in a certain
sense, if things are real, if things are real.
Yeah, you go.
Oh, go on.
Well, I was just going to say, I wonder
if things are real, they can't be manipulated. You can't manipulate reality for your own use. You can manipulate unreality. You can destroy the power center of the nuclear family by redefining gender roles and gender itself. That's why it's useful. And, you know, that's, and that's one of the reasons they do it. They don't, you know, this, like, for instance, global warming, which is a giant hoax. It's ridiculous. And it, but it's very, very, they don't care about the environment. The worst environment is China, you know, which is a communist country. Okay. It's very left wing. I remember when I was in former Yugoslavia, the environmental way. So the left doesn't care about the environment. The left cares about the power it gains by pretending to defend the environment, because that allows itself to reach into every aspect of your life, as does this insane racial gender identity shit. It allows you to reach into every corner of society, which is why they like it. But they don't care about it. If they cared about racism, for instance, how do you explain the unbelievable, mortifying attacks on black conservatives in the most despicable, disgusting racial terms from the left? It doesn't make any sense. The only answer that makes sense is that they are seeking their own power. That is all they care about in the end. That's all they want: their own power, their own position, their own prosperity, and the joy of exercising power over other people. Because it's fun to exercise power over people to some folks. Maybe to most folks. They like being in charge.
That's what's so ironic about the divide between, say, somebody with, as a citizen, with maybe a more collectivist mentality versus a more individualist mentality, is the individualist wants to make themselves as good as possible. They can then, you know, be as effective in the world as possible. The collectivist says, well, you know, my heart tells me that I want to look out for people. And then the sort of elitist left comes in and manipulates that tendency towards compassion and twists it into something that ends up delivering something that's exactly the opposite of what
But it works really well for the person who matters to the left, which is the leftist cadre. Have you noticed that all these folks who want to organize for a leftist revolution and, you know, for the workers, whatever, none of them ever want to be workers? Okay, none of them ever go, hey, I'm going to handle garbage. You handle longshoreman duties. No, they're never that. Yeah. They're never that, because that's not what they want. They want power. They will always be in a position that involves them exercising power over other people. Every single time. It is never, never something else.
Yeah, it's like, what are you talking about?
So,
you've never swung a hammer. What are you talking about? The means of labor.
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, yeah, if you notice the left now, they don't talk. I mean, they talk about Marxism, but they don't talk in Marxist terms. There's nothing about the workers. There's nothing about the proletariat. There's no dictatorship of the proletariat. It's a dictatorship. It's Marxism without, you know, actual Marxism. It's just this bizarre self-justification for their own power. And I find it bizarre that more people don't seem to see that. But then I remember how poorly educated most people are. Remember, the schools are not actually educating people. That's one of the failures of academia. You don't come out smarter than you are. People who go in are smart in the fact that they can take information and process it. But that's a neutral characteristic. You take information. Hitler took in information to process. Okay, what you need is some sort of wisdom. Wisdom is understanding human nature, nature of man, nature of God, the nature of nature. And they have none of that. But they don't want it. It doesn't get them anything. And the schools, they don't teach. Who's going to teach it? The TA with a man bun? He's going to tell you what it means. Yeah, he's going to tell you what it means to be good. No, he's going to repeat bullshit about decolonialism and, you know, here's your Marcuse book. You know, read this, which it's just, it's all a lie and it's all a scam. But you can't allow yourself to get frustrated because it doesn't make sense. Because to make sense, you have to be, you're attempting to put in a paradigm that doesn't exist. They are not there to make sense. They're not there to be reasonable. They are there to gain their own power. If you understand it through that lens, everything makes sense all the time. If you try and say, but they're not even good, they're not even effective at being leftists. Well, but their goal isn't to be leftist. It's to be have power.
And if you follow that train and you look at some of the areas that they apply their emphasis, whether it's with reproductive rights, which is essentially don't reproduce, and it, yes. And then the environmental stuff, which is let's put the brakes on all these means of production, like the real means of production, put the brakes on that.
Well, it's the means of production that guys like you and me and your listeners enjoy. It is never theirs. Bernie Sanders flew. Hey, dang dog, communist. Bernie Sanders flew around in an airplane, right? You know, destroying the environment with his carbon dioxide. But it was important that he did that. It's always important for them. But what's important for you doesn't matter. See, they want to be the people who decide what's important. You having a steak, that's not important. You having a car that's not a tiny clown car is important to you, but not to them. Now, it's important to them. And it will always be important to them. You will never see them suffer the consequences of what they demand for you. Because again, it's about their power.
And it always seems to be the case that when the power gets so concentrated, it just ends up killing everybody. I mean,
look, there's no bottom. You know, you always think, oh my gosh, it's going to get so bad, we're going to turn around, like here in California. Look at Venezuela. They are, you know, they're literally eating zebras in the zoo because they're so hungry because of socialism. If there was a bottom, they'd look at each other and go, okay, this shit ain't working. We need to try something else. They never will. There's no bottom. They have to be stopped. They have to be stopped. And where that force is at the ballot box or behind a bayonet, they've got to be stopped because they won't stop themselves. San Francisco is never going to get better. You know, the streets are covered with shit. There's hobos everywhere. Junkie, you're dodging needles in the street like punji sticks. It's fallen apart. And it will never get better until a force, whether it's their own voters getting sick of it or an outside force, comes in and forces the people in power out. There's no bottom. And if there's no bottom because people are, you know, gnawing on zebras and dodging, you know, hypodermic needles, what is the where do you believe the line exists where they say, well, that's okay, but you know, imprisoning you's not. And of course, once you get to imprisoning you, after that, where's the natural stop which says, well, I'll imprison you, but I won't murder you? Because history tells us there's no speed bump. That's flat land between those. And no one, you know, I challenge people, identify why you wouldn't. If your enemy is racist, sexist monsters who perpetuated hatred and violence, whose mere existence is violence, why again shouldn't you kill them? If that's what you truly think? I mean, where's the line? Why would you not? And of course, they'll just huff and puff and deny, but they'll never point to the line.
So, I guess that brings me to, you know, a very important and salient question, which is, you know, at what point do, I mean, what are we going to do about it? You know, are we going to vote? Is the vote going to do anything about it? Like you said, is it the ballot or is it the bayonet? And it's like, well, I mean, do we still work with the ballot here? I mean,
Right now, I am a great believer in every citizen should own firearms. In fact, I believe every citizen should own an actual military-grade assault rifle, much like in Switzerland, because that's one of the duties of citizens, to defend yourself, your family, your community, your constitution. I like the idea of citizens being serious enough that, okay, here's your rifle. You really are a citizen. You have a duty. That being said, most of it, we obviously don't have that right now. We have 400 million guns in America. And we've always been very heavily armed. And in almost 250 years, we've never had to use the Second Amendment option. Now, we had a civil war, but that was governmental entities with actual military units fighting. Except maybe you look out in Missouri, bleeding Kansas. Now, on the fringes, there were probably some guerrilla kind of stuff. But by and large, we never needed a Second Amendment solution. And we don't today. We have functional courts. We have functional ballot boxes. We have a constitution that gives us the answers to the questions that we have. Now, I believe that you have to, shit can turn around in a heartbeat. I saw it in Los Angeles, where I was on the streets for 3 weeks, 3rd Battalion, 160th Infantry, Inglewood. And, in 5 hours, my city went from a nice, normal city to a burning nightmare of murder and violence. And I was in the middle of it with the Army. So I don't put aside the possibility, and I think that you have to hedge against the possibility. That's why every citizen should be armed, and why so many are. That being said, that's not the optimal solution. That's not even a solution at all. That's a last-ditch redoubt to protect life and liberty. That is the worst-case scenario. Again, one that's never been used in almost 250 years, since the Revolutionary War. And it should be used now. I see people talking about civil war, and hell, I wrote my novels, which covers civil conflict, and I think they're a good warning. And I don't think that we shouldn't talk about it. I got told, you're just writing civil war fan fiction. Well, maybe if you talk about the problem, you can fucking solve it. I don't know. Am I crazy about that? Is that kooky? But that's not the solution. It's a last case scenario, and we're nowhere near it. Solving is going to actually take hard work. In a way, a revolution, an armed revolution's a cheat. Where we just got the slate clean and start over because we got more guns than these liberal dickheads. That's we let this get this way because we didn't do what we needed to do as citizens, which is become engaged and demand better. And that's the American way. It goes through a period where we disengage, things go on, and they're okay for a while. Then they get bad. Then people, the silent majority in 72, in 80, the people who put Reagan in, 2016, putting in Trump. We go through cycles where we come back and take charge, set the ship aright. And that's the way we do it. That's the way we should do it. So I am generally optimistic. The forces that have been unleashed are not going to change. The institutions are going to change. And they're going to change. I'm not sure exactly what they're going to change into, but they are going to change in the shadow of a backlash against kind of this leftist stuff. I wrote about that town hall on 21st of July. In my column called Brace Yourself for the Backlash. Every action has an equal and opposite reaction. And you can't have a societal change like this without people going, nah. And you see it. I don't know about in your life, but I've had people say, I didn't vote for Trump, but after this chaos, I'm totally voting for Trump. They won't say it out loud because, Trump's literally a Nazi. And that's why I'm not really super confident about the polls. Though, as we record this on July 22nd, I think Trump is losing if we had the election today. Of course, we're not going to have the election today. It's 100 and some days away. And the majority of people really aren't going to start considering September, and right now Trump is running against himself and a shadow of the old kind of dopey, goofy, good-natured Joe Biden, who is not the Joe Biden who really exists today. So the voters haven't really considered him yet. So, I mean, I think, but I think it's going, you know, I think people will become more engaged. And hopefully, you know, I want to see Trump reelected. I want to see the disruption continue. I keep thinking, you know, Trump is not all last. Trump and his movement are illegitimately foiled and suppressed. That energy is not going to go away. It's going to come back. And the guy who follows Trump may not be like Trump. He was not an authoritarian. And he is not a racist. And frankly, he's not a radical, though his behavior is outside the accepted norms of the elite. He is none of those things in any shape or form. But if they can't, they couldn't be, you know, the American people could not be heard through the Tea Party. If they're not allowed to be heard through Trump, they're going to be heard. And then that's when you start getting a situation that perhaps get a little more scary.
So it sounds like here, as in so many instances, the answer to the problems before us is sort of being thoughtful and putting forth some effort and taking some responsibility to do the things that need to be done before it veers off into something else.
Yeah. I always say the answers are right there in the Constitution. I mean, if we just do those things, we can be heard and we can be successful. Because I don't believe there's a constituency. I don't believe a vast majority of Americans wants to create this little oligarchy of leftist twits and who live life to the fullest while the rest of us endure the nightmare of their progressive vision.
I tend to agree with that. And I guess, look, we're coming up on the appointed hour, and I want to be respectful of your time. Taking into consideration this conversation, is there anything you want to sort of leave the people with as a final thought to consider before you plug your book and we suck it up?
I think I've said a lot of it. I want people to look at what's happening and understand that we're just at one of those hinge points of history where stuff has to change. And I know that's not supposedly not a conservative thing, but the reality is institutions wear out. They just don't. Things change, technology changes, culture changes. America has changed. America's not the same America as we had in 1945. When we won the Second World War. But a lot of our institutions are still, I mean, look at NATO. NATO hasn't changed really since 1950. But everything else has changed. And yet the establishment wants to keep going down that same path, not changing anything. Because there are a lot of people with an interest in the status quo. A lot of people. Look at Afghanistan, for instance. We've been there 20 years. And Donald Trump raises the idea of, you know, maybe after 20 years, you know, if Alexander the Great couldn't do it, the British couldn't do it, the Russians couldn't do it, you know, maybe after 20 years, you know, we say, okay, guys, you got to sell this yourself. Oh, and the horror. Well, there are a lot of people who are wetting their beak on what's happening over in Kabul. They've got a lot of interests in it. You know, the military, you know, the contractors have a lot of interest. Military guys have a couple different interests, one of them emotional. I mean, they've lost a lot of guys there. They don't want to be perceived as it having been for nothing. And I would argue it was not for nothing. Everybody who served there should be proud, even though the expanded mission of completely recreating the 7th century society, as anybody could see, did not succeed. The military also likes, you know, having a place you can go to be in a war. That's you know, look, firemen don't really want your house to burn down, but you know, if there were no fires, they'd be super bored. That's not an indictment of firemen. That's, they don't want a fire, but they want to be the guy to put it out. You know, so they're like, you know, maybe they're like, well, you know, there's something we can do here. I mean, we could certainly do something. Of course, they have a very mission focused. The culture of the military is to, if you don't have a problem to solve, you find a problem to solve. You know, what? Just start by watching a sergeant. If there's a private sitting there, hey, what are you doing? No, stand around. Well, if you don't have anything to do, go do police call. Go pick up trash. Do something. That's a cultural thing. I'm not saying they're bad people. You know, play Black Sabbath, War Pigs, and you know, no, it's human nature. Okay. Yeah. But the fact is there are people who have interest in this going on, even though they don't, and many of them do not see it as selfish, or they think they're doing it for good reasons. And it applies to all these institutions. All these institutions think they're absolutely essential. And in reality, many of them aren't, as we're learning. You know, when football has half the viewership it did last year, there are a lot of people out there who are going to realize, you know, I don't have to spend my Sunday watching big dudes in tights beat the shit out of each other on a rectangle. And things will change.
Yeah. Well, look, man, number one, I want to thank you for taking the time to come on.
Absolutely. I love your show, man. It's a lot of fun to, because we get to really... You know, this is not my normal push the book stuff. And we talked about before, we don't want to make this another, go buy Kurt's book. If you want to buy my book, buy it. I like the book. I think it's funny. I think you'll enjoy it. But I like talking about kind of these deeper issues because, you know, if you're on with Frodo and the Boner in Zoo Duluth, you know, they really don't want to talk about the nature of our institutions and, you know, how all these pieces fit together. So I appreciate the chance to kind of sound off about this stuff, exercise some of these ideas, see where they take us. I mean, I don't know if I'm right or not. I think I am, but I think I've called it pretty good so far.
Frodo, cue the laugh track.
Boy, yo, 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 yo.
Canned laughter. Yeah. Well, look, I always like to try to pick your brain and try to get to some of the stuff beneath the surface. And I appreciate you taking the time to do it. And it's the 21 biggest lies about Donald Trump. Thanks. And use the book, right?
Yep. Go check it out.
And I agree. I mean, I'm suggesting you read the book. It's funny. It's interesting. It's thoughtful. And that's, I mean, what more could you ask for? And even if you're not necessarily a Trump guy, the principles and the things that Kurt talks about in the book are relevant to you regardless of how you feel about Trump. So you might want to go spend a little time, have a couple of laughs, and learn a thing or two.
Appreciate it.
Yes, sir. So look, if you're good, I'm good. You can get your dinner. And
all right. Thanks a lot, man. I go to sleep so I can get up at 1 a.m.
Yes, sir. In that case,
Terrible
Podcast. I've been Chance Lunsford. He's been Kurt Schlichter. And this has all been Allegedly, and we are out.